From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Election season is underway, and the race for Florida's governor is filling up, leading to questions about who has whose endorsement.
How much does his endorsement still matter in the state?
Also this week, we remember the tragic shooting that took place 10 years ago at Pulse Nightclub.
I was transported back to 10 years ago, and I started crying.
We'll also hear about a new state law that's bringing cursive writing back to the classroom and efforts to protect roseate spoonbills, a pink wading bird that was once on the brink of extinction. I'm Regan McCarthy, on air and online. This is Capitol Report and our end-of-the-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. Election season has officially kicked off. One of the most watched contests on the ballot this year will be the gubernatorial race. With Governor Ron DeSantis in the last year of his final term, the candidates to replace him are lining up. WFSU's political reporter Tristan Wood spoke with Spectrum News 13's Jason Delgado about how the field is looking heading into the August primary.
Jason, going on, you know, the state voter registration and voter information reg's website, it seems that the field for governor this year is so packed. I know that's not atypical, but I've seen 21 candidates have qualified to run for governor so far. In that race, what candidates are you watching? What candidates do you think are the most relevant so far?
Sure. Yeah. And thanks for having me on. Look, I think when it comes to the Democratic field, you know, as you know, that's kind of set in stone at this point. It looks like we have, you know, former Congressman David Jolly sit there with his running mate, Gwen Graham. But as you pointed out, on the GOP side, one could almost argue the same. There's no doubting that Congressman Byron Donalds is the front runner. Almost every poll shows that, at least poll that you could, you know, seems rooted in some sort of reality. And he's also the Trump endorsed candidate. And that in this state carries a lot of weight. So clearly Byron Donalds is a front runner here. But it's worth mentioning, you know, you have Lieutenant Governor Jay Collins. He's still out there putting up a fight, still without an endorsement from Governor Ron DeSantis, which was highly expected, at least early on. So we're still without that. And then you have House Speaker Paul Renner, probably, you know, arguably perhaps the most qualified person on this ticket, just given his resume as the former Florida House Speaker, serving in concert with Governor Ron DeSantis, also a Navy veteran, a former prosecutor. But the reality is both Collins and Speaker Renner just aren't gaining notable traction in this primary race. So, it looks like the road's paved for Congressman Donalds. But anything can happen, Tristan.
Gotcha. Why do you think Donalds got that endorsement? Why do you think he's positioned so well?
I think it's not unreasonable nor fair to say that President Donald Trump values his allies. And Congressman Byron Donalds has very much been that throughout the years. He's been a very vocal supporter of the president. He's appeared endlessly on cable news, especially Fox News, defending President Trump, defending his agenda. And that seemingly has earned the admiration of President Donald Trump. And that's what gave him very early on, mind you, what scored him that endorsement from the president.
Yeah, I understand. As far as fundraising, the Trump endorsement, polling information, frequent appearances on national conservative media, Byron Donalds is definitely the clear front runner in that race. And it doesn't appear close at this point. There's another candidate that you didn't mention that's a kind of a political newcomer that's grabbed a lot of national headlines, that James Fishback character. What's going on with him?
He is an outsider, political outsider, if you will. And the reason we're talking about him, and everyone seems, not everyone, but you understand what I'm getting at, why he demands a conversation is because he is very effective at social media. At least it seems. He has a very large social media presence. And it seems like he's attracting a much younger demographic within the GOP. And with that said, he's also said some controversial things that has also garnered a lot of attention. I know you've covered him to that degree. There's also been several national pieces kind of looking at James Fishback as a potential a figure to watch in the GOP in the years to come. But the fact does remain that in terms of Mr. Fishback, the fundraising just doesn't appear there. Just because you have so many followers, say on X, that doesn't, mean that translates into a ton of money in your war chest. And so, with that said, it's very hard to mount a challenge, to topple at least a Trump-endorsed candidate, when you don't have the resources to do it.
And why does fundraising matter so much in these Florida races, these top of ticket races?
It sounds pessimistic, but money is largely the name of the game. It's how you get your name out there. It's how you get yourself physically around the state. It's how you flood, the radio markets, the TV markets, the social media ads. It is staffing and canvassing. It's kind of what makes the clock tick in a political campaign. And that sounds so pessimistic, but it is the reality that it takes cash to run a campaign, an effective campaign. And it's hard to do it without it.
Heard there. And even if Fishback had a war chest or any of these other candidates had more money, the reality is with Trump's endorsement, Trump polls very popular with more kind of baby boomer generation and older voters, which are disproportionately such a massive voting block in Florida. One of the takeaways I had in my coverage of Fishback is, he resembles his campaign strategies almost resemble a lot of kind of what Zohran Mamdani from the populist left pulled off in New York, kind of with viral social media marketing targeting millennials and Gen Z. But in reality, the voters that are going to show up in this August 18th primary aren't overwhelmingly going to be Gen Z and millennials. New York City is very different than the full state of Florida. And voters in that primary election are going to be overwhelmingly older, which are not as easily persuaded by flashy vertical videos or younger trending social media trends. So I agree with your assessment that it appears that Byron Donalds is the front runner for now. There is, still 2 months left in this race to see what happens, but there's no indication that kind of this pecking order is going to change at this point.
And Tristan, I don't know where the commonalities end between those two, but I will 100% agree with you. Both Mamdani and James Fishback are effective at communication and their messaging and what they want to say and how they say it.
As we're heading, into these August 18th primaries, is there anything else you're watching or just any other takeaways that you have?
Well, I think it'll be interesting. I think at a national level, there's curiosity about what is President Donald Trump's sway over his bloc. Is it still intact? I think it is, of course, it is to some degree. But how much does his endorsement still matter in the state?
Additionally, just for listeners, just a quick reminder, these primaries are going to be on August 18th, but the filing deadline to register to vote in the primaries is July 20th. So if you're interested in participating in this primary election, make sure that you up make sure your voter registration is complete and up to date by July 20th. And thank you so much, Jason, for the time. I really appreciate it.
Tristan, I appreciate you, my friend. Thank you.
This week marks 10 years since the Pulse nightclub shooting, where a gunman opened fire, injuring 58 and killing another 49 people. Pulse was a safe space for the LGBTQ plus community, and that day is widely considered Orlando's darkest day. Central Florida Public Media's Joe Mario Pedersen spoke with the mother of one of the victims. He also talked with experts about grief and why it tends to be more powerful during milestone remembrances.
For Christine Leinonen, June 12, 2016 is a day she will never forget. It's the day her son, Christopher Drew Leinonen, and his boyfriend, Juan Ramon Guerrero, had gone to Pulse nightclub for a Latin dance night. The two men were among the 49 people killed there that day.
That thought always brings me back to my little, because I still think of my son, he was 32, but I still think of him being a little one. He's just a little, my little son. He's my little baby. He's my little fourth grader laying on the floor of that club.
Leinonen recalls waking up at 3 a.m. and seeing a Facebook post from one of Christopher's friends about an attack at Pulse. She got in her car and drove from Polk County, a bit more than an hour away, to a 7-Eleven about a block from the club, hoping to get answers. She ended up about a mile away at Orlando Regional Hospital, where hundreds of other people were also looking for information about their loved ones. That night, Orlando police began escorting families to a conference room, asking for pictures and other identifiable information. She was then told to go home. She did, but according to a post she wrote online, once she arrived home, she was asked to drive right back. After a total of 33 hours waiting for the dreaded news, Orlando police confirmed that Christopher was one of the victims. It's been a long time since that day, but Leinonen says that the grief of losing her son still sneaks up on her. Last week, she was driving.
And I was transported right back to 10 years ago, and I started crying as if I was like, come on, Christine, it's 10 years. And
usually, she channels her grief into LGBTQ+ and Pulse activism, but lately, Leinonen says the pain has been more powerful.
Well, I'm a little sadder than most years. I don't know if 10 years is just piling on the, you know, the gravity of 10 years is just feeling heavier on my heart this year than most years.
That's a common feeling, according to Deborah Beidle. She's the executive director of a University of Central Florida research center working to better treat people with post-traumatic stress disorder.
And so I think this idea that there's a certain pathway and that there are certain milestones that we all have to reach at the same time, I think that's one of the biggest misunderstandings.
Beidle worked with survivors, family members, and first responders after Pulse.
I think what we see in a lot of the survivors is they learn to live with it. I think for some people, they're going to have maybe a little bit of a shock because as we all talk more and as we get close to that date, people who think that maybe they were over it are going to find they have some symptoms again.
But those feelings aren't isolated to those directly impacted by the tragedy. The reach of the Pulse shooting was wide, as are the feelings of grief, says John Super, a UCF professor of psychology who also worked with victims and families.
They didn't know that neighbor. They knew they were close. They were 2 degrees of separation from the massacre itself.
While those unexpected moments of grief that may occur now can be hard, Beidle and Super both say it's part of the healing process and everyone's path is a little different.
People are going to do this in their own period of time, and we have to accept that everybody's going to do it when it's right for them.
As the healing process continues, many recognize that the community has changed, but not all the change is painful. After the Pulse tragedy, Central Florida responded in a big way. People donating blood and supplies, people donning large white angel wings made from PVC pipe and white fabric as a means of spreading love and protecting those in need. 50,000 people at a candlelit vigil in downtown Orlando.
This community's response was just beautiful. And I think the sentiment still exists.
Among the throngs of people to come to that vigil was a large group of Muslim women.
For a lot of us, we were like, we want to go, but how will that make people that are there feel if a bunch of Muslims showed up?
That's Fatima Sadaf Saeed, co-founder of the Muslim Women Organization. She says because the shooter claimed allegiance to the Islamic State, Central Florida Muslims were hesitant to come out and support. Saeed says they were afraid they would be met with anger. But that didn't happen.
There were people giving out flowers, and they turned to us and gave us flowers and gave us hugs. And I think everybody needed that.
That shared pain, that grief, broke down walls between different communities. Saeed says that the group was welcome at churches and LGBTQ+ functions following the days of Pulse.
Honestly, not really having interacted much with the LGBT community. until that moment in time.
That was difficult for the Muslim group, she said. Gay and trans people are not typically seen in a kind light in Muslim teaching, Saeed said. But after being welcomed by churches and the LGBTQ plus groups, Saeed says the local Muslim community is evolving in its views.
And I think we are a much better community because of it, you know, and we've been able to navigate issues about, you know, trans Muslims in the community and queer Muslims, all kinds of things that have come up in those days after. We've been able to navigate it in a way that is much more compassionate, merciful.
She says it's still a struggle for some in the community, but the Muslim Women Organization has evolved in a progressive direction.
Disasters and hardship, sadly, bring people together. As with any disaster, a flower that has bloomed, right, after.
As for Christine Leinonen, she's never gone to a remembrance ceremony. On days that remind her of Christopher, like holidays, Leinonen treats them like any other day.
Making them into days is just so painful. It's just more pain than my heart can handle. I just choose not to go. And maybe one day I will go. Maybe even this year I'll go. Who knows? I could change my mind.
Joe Mario Pedersen in Orlando.
Coming up on Capitol Report, a new law is bringing cursive back to the classroom, and some experts say it's needed.
A decade ago, every student in the classroom, or most students, would have been able to read it pretty simply, as if they were reading a typewritten document. And now, like, there's a visible struggle.
And we hear about efforts to bring a gangly pink bird back from what was once the brink of extinction.
Roseate spoonbills are an indicator species, which can tell us a little bit about the health of its surrounding ecosystem.
Florida's new congressional map creating four more U.S. House Republican-leading districts will remain for the midterms. WUSF's Douglas Soule reports the state Supreme Court declined to take up an emergency request to block it.
Genesis Robinson heads the Equal Ground Education Fund, one of the advocacy groups suing the state.
Our view of this action is still the same. The action taken by the Florida legislature amounts to a partisan power grab in service to Donald Trump.
Trump has pushed GOP states to redistrict in a battle for the U.S. House majority. Some Democratic states have responded, but Florida has constitutional restrictions against partisan gerrymandering. Evan Power, chair of the Republican Party of Florida, applauds the decision.
I think that people are going to find that the new maps are fair and compact and will give them more of a chance to weigh in on who they want to represent them.
A lower court must hear the case first, but already declined to fast track it. I'm Douglas Soule in Tallahassee.
Governor Ron DeSantis recently signed a sweeping education law. It includes a mandate that students in public schools must demonstrate proficiency in reading and cursive writing by the end of fifth grade. On WGCU's Southwest Florida in Focus, Yonju Park explores the current state of cursive and its implementation in education.
Based on new legislation signed by Governor Ron DeSantis, students in third through fifth grades across all Florida public schools must show mastery in cursive writing. Yes, cursive writing is back, starting this school year. And by the looks of it, you would have thought that some kids had seen a dinosaur.
What? Oh, probably gonna fail that.
For me, it takes too long and it's like, looks, I don't know, I just hate like the way it looks.
Others are ready to tackle this challenge.
I think it was for Christmas. My aunt gave me a cursive writing book.
Cursive writing has always been a staple in Vanessa Mazzotta's third grade classroom in Lee County's Alva schools. She explains that although cursive writing strikes fear in the hearts of students, she has a system in place.
We start with tracing the letters, and then they start with writing the letters on their own. We'll use Play-Doh and different types of modeling clay for them to work the hand muscles to get them stronger. And they'll use that to also form letters on their desk as a part of like morning work. once they have been practicing it enough, we'll start copying sentences down, and usually the sentences are fun or somewhat gross facts that the kids really find funny in the morning to copy down.
In her years of teaching, Mazada says building up students' tactile stamina lays the foundation for writing success.
When you're on an iPad or a phone or a tablet, and you're just scrolling on there, you're not using the same types of muscles in your hand. So a lot of kids become very fatigued with actual handwriting. So by building up their muscles, it really helps them to become more efficient with it.
The new Florida law requires that all public elementary schools follow this mandate. Cursive writing has been resuscitated from 2010, when it was dropped as part of the National Common Core standards. The curriculum gap for over a decade has led cursive writing to fall by the wayside nationally. It's hindering routine tasks such as signing forms and checks, according to middle school teacher Julie Tomsick. She says another hurdle is that some parents don't have cursive writing skills themselves.
When I taught preschool back in Georgia, I had a lot of parents that they would put a parent signature, they would print their name because they did not have a signature because they couldn't have cursive.
This knowledge deficit is evident to archivists like Victoria Jones, who started a cursive writing class at the Florida Gulf Coast University, specifically to counter a worrisome trend among budding researchers.
Even documents that I would consider to be quite clean, well-written cursive documents, a decade ago, every student in the classroom or most students would have been able to read it pretty simply as if they were reading a typewritten document. And now, like, there's a visible struggle.
Jones says the continued preservation of American history depends on the knowledge of cursive writing.
If you are interested in American history, you need to be able to read cursive, like English cursive script. Most correspondence, even official documents, letters, all kinds of things were written in cursive up and through the 1980s, 90s, even the early 2000s. So if you can't read cursive, you're kind of creating, there's a barrier then to accessing that information.
Archivists are beginning to transcribe handwritten historical materials. But given the extent and scope of collections, this is naturally a glacial undertaking due to Herculean resources required for transcriptions. In contrast to workarounds for society's lack of cursive writing knowledge, Tomsick says the buildup of the skill will just make people's lives easier.
I think people don't realize how long it takes to print letters and to learn cursive, and you can see how much faster writing goes when you don't have to lift up your pencil as much.
Teaching cursive writing in grade schools means that kids can get an early start to developing long-range civic skills. I'm Yeonju Park.
You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Regan McCarthy. Finally this week, by the early 20th century, the roseate spoonbill was hunted to the brink of extinction. By the 1930s, there were believed to be only 30 breeding pairs in Florida. WGCU's Southwest Florida in Focus host Jennifer Crawford sits down with Shauna Sayers, a wading bird research specialist at Audubon's Everglades Research Station, to learn about preservation efforts.
For more on the roseate spoonbill, we are joined by Shauna Sayers. She is a wading bird research specialist at Audubon's Everglades Research Station. Thank you so much for joining us today, Ms. Sayers.
Thank you for having me.
Now, it is very interesting to note that the roseate spoonbills are the only native spoonbill to Florida. What makes these birds so special?
Yeah, they, as you said, are the only native spoonbill to Florida and the Americas. And unlike many other wading birds, they hunt primarily through tactile foraging, which means they feel around using their spoon-shaped bill to find fish and other prey species. They're pink, which everyone loves a pink bird. Yeah, I think they're one of the more recognizable birds in America, and it's just always a pleasure when you get to see them out there.
They are beautiful.
Yeah.
Now, by the 1930s, they were almost hunted to extinction, mainly for their plumage. Can you talk about what efforts were made nearly 100 years ago that has increased their numbers?
Yeah, so some conservation efforts that really help them benefit and increase their numbers would be the Migratory Bird Act that was passed in 1918, public designated nesting efforts and protections for these birds, and overall a kind of a change in societal attitude towards wildlife, more appreciation, and this research and other conservation efforts kind of helped them slowly gain and rebound in their population.
A recent report from Florida Bay showed some incredible results. It mentioned that there's a 66% success rate in nesting among 22 active colonies. That's remarkable. How has that been accomplished?
Yeah, so this year we had a really great team. We had a lot of effort out there going out every 7 to 10 days to check up on the nest that we were monitoring. And from there, we would follow those chicks through development and see if they eventually get to fledging, which if at least one chick from each nest makes it, then that is considered a success. And so we had overall 244 nests we were monitoring, and 239 we were able to decipher whether the nest was successful or a failure. And from that, we got our 66% success rate.
The National Audubon Society's first director of research, Robert Porter Allen, had to find unique ways to study these birds. And I understand he spent weeks in a tent among their colonies. How has that approach changed and evolved into how you're able to track and record the species today?
Yeah, Robert Porter Allen, yeah, gotta give him credit. I can't imagine sleeping with the mosquitoes out there. But yeah, he did a lot for monitoring birds in general. And we do similar yet different in that we don't camp out there, but we're still going out on the ground and searching for these nests and getting in the mangroves, crawling around. So it is very similar, but there's also some other tactics that we're looking into, such as GPS tracking to monitor their northward movement.
Besides checking numbers, what can you learn from the research of birds like the roseate spoonbill as far as how they provide a snapshot of what's going on in the ecosystem?
Yeah, so roseate spoonbills are an indicator species, which can tell us a little bit about the health of its surrounding ecosystem. The Everglades is a very complex system, so we use roseate spoonbills to monitor its health. Roseate spoonbills depend on specific water heights that have prey frisk concentration that allow them to forage and feed their chicks. So by measuring their nesting success, we can see if the flow down of the water from the Everglades is at a basis that can allow for subaquatic vegetation and prey frisk concentration. So kind of in a simpler term, if the spoonbills aren't doing well, then there's probably something else in the Everglades ecosystem that is not.
Now, if anyone lives near a spoonbill nest, is there anything they should be aware of to help keep these species doing well?
Yeah, always give them some space. They have a lot of personality and they're very fun to watch, but make sure you do so from a distance and give them the proper time and space that they need to forage and raise their young. We also have a long-term banding program. So if you ever see a spoonbill with a colored leg band, take a picture and make sure to report it through our Google form, and you'll also receive a limited edition spoonbill sticker in the mail.
Where can people go to find more about roseate spoonbills and Audubon Florida?
Yes, go to the National Audubon Society website, specifically Audubon Florida roseate spoonbills, and you'll find the link there.
That was Shauna Sayers of Audubon's Everglades Research Station speaking with WGCU's Southwest Florida in Focus host Jennifer Crawford. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Randy Buxta, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Joe Mario Pedersen, Yeon Jun Park, and Jennifer Crawford. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox. I'm Regan McCarthy. We hope you'll join us again next week on air and online for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.